I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this primary day, the 5th of April in the state of Wisconsin. And in a long-standing tradition, probably as long as 99 years, as long as this station has been on the air, we will not talk about the primary today. It is your day to vote. But tonight, we will have election returns when the polls close tonight at 8 o'clock. Tune in to Wisconsin Public Radio for the latest election news and analysis. We'll have results, of course, from the Wisconsin presidential primary, the race for the state Supreme Court, election coverage tonight beginning at 8 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio, and tomorrow, many shows, of course, we'll be focusing on what we do today. We will have a full panel with us tomorrow afternoon during this particular hour, doing a recap of Wisconsin primary results with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert, Tim Murphy of Mother Jones, and many others. So we're not ignoring the day. We're just giving you the day to vote. This hour, five players on the U.S. women's soccer team acting on behalf of the entire women's team filed a federal complaint last week accusing U.S. Soccer of wage discrimination. The filing cites figures from the U.S. Soccer Federation's 2015 financial report showing the women's team generated nearly $20 million more in revenue last year than the U.S. men's team, but the women were paid a quarter of what the men earn. The EEOC will be conducting an investigation. U.S. soccer officials cite figures that the Federation said shows the men's national team produced revenue and attendance about double that of the women's team, and TV ratings are much higher than what the women attract. The Federation says an agreement which expired in 2012 lives on in a memorandum of understanding that the sides signed in early 2013. The union says it does not. We are going to have three guests with us during the course of the hour. A litigation partner in Winston & Strawn's New York office, Ava Cole, will join us at the top of the show, part of the team that's representing the women's soccer players. Michael Powell will join us then, the man behind the New York Times Sports of the Times column. And later on in the show, Michael Leroy, who's a professor of labor and employment relations and of law at the College of Law at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. We did reach out to you. U.S. Soccer, they did not respond. They have offered other news outlets this response. While we've not seen this complaint and can't comment on the specifics of it, we're disappointed about this action. We've been a world leader in women's soccer and are proud of the commitment we've made to building the women's game in the U.S. over the past 30 years. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of the hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd love to read your comments, and we're on Twitter as well. Ava Cole is a litigation partner in Winston & Strawn's New York office. She's part of the team, as I said, that's representing the women's soccer players, and they are a law firm considered one of the country's most formidable law firms representing many, many athletes. Ava, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Let's start with what was done. I believe in early January, the women's national team players submitted a proposal for a new collective bargaining agreement that had, as your coworker says, equal pay for equal work as its guiding principle. What did you submit?
Well, I think submitting is overstating. We've been engaged with U.S. Soccer regarding the terms of a new collective bargaining agreement since about early January. And at its core is this concept, equal pay for equal work. You know, the women for many years have been paid less than their male counterparts. And at this stage of the game, given the significant successes in particular that the women have had, they felt that it was time that they be compensated fairly for the work that they do.
And the team has just had these rip-roaring successes, right?
Yeah, it is pretty pretty remarkable. They have won 3 World Cup titles and 4 Olympic gold medals, which actually is an accomplishment that no other country on either the men's or the women's side has reached an Olympic competition. So the success has been outstanding.
And tell me more about the pay disparity. How significant is it? Where do you find it?
So The pay disparity is, in fact, quite significant, and it exists at every level of compensation that we see in terms of how the women and the men get paid. The compensation structure is somewhat complicated. It's not just sort of a salary-based structure on either the women's or the men's side. There's sort of a number of different buckets that the compensation falls into, but sort of in each of those buckets, the women are paid significantly less than men. For example, I'll just give you one. There are the so-called friendly games, which are sort of the national, you know, run-of-the-mill games. We're not talking about World Cup, and we're not talking about the Olympics. But just with respect to those games, the women players get between 38% and 72% of the compensation that the men players earn on a per-game basis. The World Cup differences are even bigger. There, women players get $30,000 for trying out and making the World Cup team roster, and the men get more than twice that. They get $68,000. And then the pay structure for advancement through the rounds of the World Cup is also dramatically skewed. So, for example, in 2015, the men's team earned $9 million for losing in the round of 16, and the women's team earned $2 million for being world champions. So it really is sort of across levels of compensation that you see this very, very significant pay disparity.
I did read somewhere, is this right, Ava, that the men's team is standing behind the women?
Yes, and you know, I think what's important for the women and what they would tell you is that, you know, the women aren't arguing that they're better than the men. You know, they believe that the women are valuable to U.S. soccer, the men are valuable to U.S. soccer, and everyone's doing their part to support the game and to support the sport. And there should be an equality reflected simply because both the men and the women are doing the same job. And under our U.S. laws, that's all that's required. If you're doing the same work, you should be paid the same, whether you're a woman or a man.
Mm-hmm. U.S. Soccer did not agree to be on the show today, so that's too bad, but I will have to say what they have said. They are citing figures that show that the men's national team produced revenue and attendance about double that of the women's team, and their TV ratings are much higher than what the women attract. They also say that there was an agreement expired in 2012 that lives on in a memorandum of understanding that the sides signed in early 2013. What do you say to both those areas?
Well, so let me start with the first point. And the first point that I would make is, in terms of revenue, there really can be no dispute that the women are a major driver of revenues. And that's clear from the financial statements of U.S. Soccer. But even leaving that aside, There's no basis to tie the revenues directly to the compensation. It's not the way that they're paid. They're not paid for how many revenues they drive or how much money they produce for the U.S. Soccer Federation. They're paid to play the game. They're paid to practice. They're paid to go to the games and do the same thing that the men are paid to do. And that's really the basis for the charge that's been filed. And that's what U.S. law requires. That's what the Equal Pay Act requires. So that's sort of point one. With respect to point two, it's sort of neither here nor there because, you know, at the end of the day, the women are now seeking to renegotiate, and they believe that they're entitled for wages that are equal to that of their male counterparts. And that's where we are now, and I think the women would hope that U.S. Soccer Federation comes around to this concept.
Mm-hmm. So they do plan, U.S. Soccer Federation, this memorandum of understanding is in effect, I understand, until the end of 2016, and then there are supposed to be talks for a new agreement, a new compensation agreement, is that right?
Well, again, it's sort of an unrelated issue.
I see.
It's sort of an unrelated issue. The main point here is that the women believe that pursuant to the Equal Pay Act, they have not been fairly compensated, and that on a going forward basis, they should get equal pay for equal work.
Mm-hmm. And is it the entire U.S. women's team, or is it five players? Who all's involved in this?
So there are five main players that have brought the complaint. It's Hope Solo, Carly Lloyd, Megan Rapinoe, Rebecca Sauerbrunn, and Alex Morgan. But they have brought this charge on behalf of the entire women's national team.
And they're also a bit concerned that they're playing on artificial turf in some of these places, and they're concerned about accommodations that are quite different than what the men get, natural grass and better accommodations.
Yeah, that's right. So as I said at the outset, the disparity in pay sort of trickles down to nearly every aspect of the relationship between the women's national team players and the federation. So just sort of by way of example, the federation pays men a per diem of $62.50 for domestic venues and $75 for international venues. The women, on the other hand, get $50 for domestic venues and $60 for the international ones, even though they're doing the same amount of travel, if not more, quite frankly, and for the same reasons. You know, sponsor appearances are compensated differently. And the list goes on and on. As you said, with respect to the turf issue, you know, the women are often playing on artificial turf, which is a really a danger issue. There's a risk that they can get injured playing on that artificial turf. And in fact, more than one of them has. And the men don't face that same obstacle. Mm-hmm. So it's just another example of the inequities.
And Ava, what's happening now? The EEOC is conducting an investigation. Is that underway right now?
So the charge was just filed last Wednesday, and it typically takes the EEOC a couple of weeks after it receives a charge to initiate an investigation. Once it does so, it typically takes some time. So we would expect that an investigation would continue anywhere from between 6 months and even longer, maybe, you know, up to 10 months. But that's what we do expect. We expect the EEOC will launch an investigation and will look into these allegations itself.
So you don't expect it to be decided before the Olympics in Rio?
I think that might be an ambitious timeline.
Mm-hmm. And do you imagine, considering the focus on the women's team right now and their incredible success, that you've got public opinion behind you, or do you find that you have to explain yourself quite a bit to get everybody to say, ooh, there is a problem here?
Well, I'll tell you, when we filed the charge and it became public, the outpouring of public support was astronomical. People seem to have pretty strong views on this right now, and I think the support is wholeheartedly behind the women. You know, they are star players, and they have achieved remarkable success on behalf of the United States. But I think even leaving that aside, people recognize this concept of equal pay for equal work, and you know, what better time than the present to make that happen in the sports world.
Thank you, Ava, so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ava Cole, litigation partner in Winston & Strawn's New York office, and she is part of the team that is led by Jeffrey Kessler, who's represented many players, unions, and athletes. She is part of the team that is representing the women's soccer players. In early January, the women's national player team submitted an idea for a new collective bargaining agreement that did have, as Ava has said, equal pay for equal work as the guiding principle. U.S. Soccer responded by suing the players in an effort to keep in place the agreement that they have had, which has, as you heard her outline, pretty significant pay disparities. We are going to hear from a couple other people as we continue here, but I'm also interested in you. Do you think, as you hear about this, that this is a significant issue when it comes to equal pay and equal work? Are you behind the women players, or do you think that, as U.S. Soccer has said, unfortunately they didn't agree to be on the show with us, that the men's national team has more money and more attendance and better TV ratings, but when you look at the wins and the attention that the women's team has been receiving, playing on artificial turf instead of playing on natural grass, accommodations are not the same, and the pay disparity is pretty huge. But is it a matter of equal pay for equal work? What do you think? We'd love to hear from you. Here is how we hear from you. 800-4 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. We continue the conversation. Michael Powell will be joining us, man behind the New York Times Sports of the Times column. And later in the show, a professor of labor and employment relations and of law at the College of Law at the University of Illinois at Champaign. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we're getting a lot of phone calls coming in on this issue. We have two more guests with us, and then I promise you we will be getting to your phone calls. Michael Powell is the man behind the Sports of the Times column. He worked for the Gray Ladies Metro Desk, and before that, the business section. Previously wrote for the Washington Post and New York Newsday. Michael Powell, hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, my pleasure.
Yeah, great to have you here. And Michael Leroy is with us. He is a professor of labor and employment relations and of law at the College of Law at the University of Illinois at Champaign, has published on antitrust in professional sports, immigration, employment policy, strikes, and lockouts. And Professor Leroy, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let me ask both of you first, do the women have a point here? Is there, when you look at this, a great disparity? Michael Powell?
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, you know, whether it's, I think it sometimes gets conflated, well, they should be paid with, they should be paid exactly what the men are paid, and I think that's a separate discussion, but it's certainly in sort of ways, sometimes almost more noticeable, small than large, they're paid less than the men. I mean, they even get less per diems.
Right.
They get less. And, yeah, so I think that if you're viewing this as a business, you know, that soccer, that is men and women are involved in building in the United States, it seems to me there's a pretty reasonable argument that they should be making something, you know, something more closely approximating what the men are.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Professor Leroy? What do you think?
I think on the facts, the women have a compelling case for better pay, if not equal pay, for the reasons Michael has stated and probably mentioned earlier in your show. I mean, there's nothing that meets the eyeball test here that looks like it's fair or reasonable. But I do think the women have an uphill climb here. And just to be succinct about it, they have a memorandum of understanding, which the Federation is saying that's a labor agreement, and you folks signed in on that, and now you want to opt out. You can't opt out. So that's going to be a legal barrier and a very significant hurdle. But I think the more fundamental issue is that there has been inequity in pay for women dating back to the enactment of Title VII. In 1964, and you know, a very deep and important question to ask is, so why should the women's soccer team be accorded equal pay or pay parity when you've got millions of women who are in similar situations, and they've been frustrated in their legal attempts to gain fair pay?
Women outside of sports, you're saying?
Yes. Oh, uh-huh. Clearly. I mean,
right.
We have repeated empirical evidence that women, when you norm for education, when you control for the demands of a job and so forth, women are paid less than men. It's hard to find an industry where women are paid the same, except when you go to the rock bottom of the pay scale where everybody's getting minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. So does this strike you as an indication, perhaps, if the women should be successful, Michael Powell, that it could go beyond the world of sports?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, you know, as Professor was saying, you know, all of this stuff is to some extent connected. And sure, I mean, I think to the extent that high-profile women, you know, in a fight for pay equity, if they are successful in large part, yeah, I mean, I think there's always ramifications. I mean, you want to hesitate against, you know, sort of overstating that, right? And, you know, that once this happens, a new day dawns. No, but I think that it certainly raises the awareness of this. And, I mean, frankly, you know, I wrote a column on this last week, and several colleagues wrote very good pieces on this, and the kind of commentary that is from readers was extraordinary. I mean, we just got an extraordinary response, And, you know, particularly on women, I mean, I think you heard this, you know, kind of echo again and again, that this is, you know, a sense that this is, a time has come to kind of start addressing this stuff.
Yeah. You would think at least U.S. Soccer, who declined to be on this show, would make sure that they had playing conditions that were the same as men. Why would the women be on artificial turf, which can be dangerous and not on natural grass? Why would they have a per diem that's lower than men? You would have thought that that's something that you would just kind of basically do, wouldn't you?
Yes, and I think that in fact, that U.S. soccer is feeling a lot of pressure on those sort of things. I mean, it's absolutely true that they have, well, I should say it's absolutely true they had a collective bargaining agreement. It's not, I guess there is some dispute as to whether that still holds today, but certainly it's hard to look at, as I say, things like per diems, which are, you know, really kind of pocket change, and not think that U.S. soccer would kind of take care of that sort of elementary inequality today.
Mm-hmm. Professor Leroy, let's go back to this memorandum of understanding. Evidently, they signed an agreement. It expired in 2012. The memorandum signed in early 2013. If you've had a string of successes and worldwide attention that the women's team has had in the last couple of years, can't you say, well, let's move on from that memorandum of understanding because things have changed since 2013?
You can say that, and that's essentially what they are saying. You can run that in the other direction, though. If you picture the team being unsuccessful and rocked by scandal and having difficulties, and then if you know, the league says, well, we don't like the agreement, the MOU we made with you back in 2012 or whenever it was, I don't think the women would take kindly to the argument that that's not an agreement, that's an MOU, and that's legally different. So I do think once you get in the world of signing a document, and as I understand it, I haven't seen it, but it's a signed document, the fact that it's called an MOU versus a CBA is going to be legally insignificant. But, you know, to go back to the earlier point, it's outrageous that they're put at the back of the plane. I mean, that's so wrong, and the imagery around it is so wrong. But, you know, soccer's not the only area where leagues are rife with hypocrisy and unfair treatment.
In sports, what else is?
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's start with the NCAA and the assertion that it's amateur athletics. Even though you had tens of millions of people watching a game of student-athletes last night for the NCAA finals. I mean, and those guys aren't getting paid any money. They're getting a nice education. But that strikes many people as hypocritical. And why aren't the men's why isn't Villanova's basketball team getting a bigger cut of the pie, and the UNC for that matter? So I don't minimize the inequity that women on this team are, the inequities that they're experiencing, mm-hmm. Not at all. But the issue is, so legally, what's going to happen that to benefit them? And again, I think they have an uphill climb.
Mm-hmm. Michael Powell, what about other sports? What about inequities?
Well, I mean, I think that if you look at it, it kind of depends on the sport. So I had a number of readers, I have to say all males, getting in touch with me and saying, well, look at the WNBA, that is the Women's Professional Basketball Association, and they, you know, they make less money, but they also draw many fewer fans. They their television ratings are, you know, I mean, just minimal. On the other hand, you could look, you know, you could as easily look, and I would argue perhaps with more justice, at the tennis, you know, women's tennis, mm-hmm. where they get very purses that are very close approximations of the men. In some cases, the women's, famously the women's final at the U.S. Open last year drew, sold out faster and had bigger ratings than the men's final. And that is a sport that has been roughly, I mean, you don't want to overstate it, but has been in a rough state of, approximate or equity between men and women for some time. Men get a lot more, they get a lot kind of extras on the side, they sign bigger sponsorship agreements, but the women really do quite well, and they draw big crowds, and they draw big television ratings. And I think that it's reasonable to look at what happened with the women's soccer last year when they also drew enormous television ratings, and then when they went on their victory tour, they drew very big crowds. And I think you could reasonably look at that and say, well, you know, they appear. You want to be careful with that, but to be on a trajectory that puts this sport in kind of more the orbit of tennis than it does, say, basketball.
Mm-hmm. So what can the women soccer players learn from the women tennis players?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, look, I think what the professor is saying strikes me as, you know, sort of a big problem for them, right, in that they do have this MOU that they signed. On the other hand, you know, I think when you look at the reaction, frankly, to their filing with the federal government last week, they're putting an awful lot of pressure, sort of societal pressure, on U.S. soccer. And I think that it strikes me, I mean, and I'm hardly in the business of advising them, but it strikes me that that's a pretty good route to go. It is clear that U.S. soccer is feeling an enormous amount of pressure in the last week, and I am sure they would like it to go away. In fairness to U.S. soccer, they've actually done a pretty good job at the grassroots level of building female participation, you know, at the sort of teenage and even under teenage level with soccer. That's all wonderful. Do they really want to have this kind of battle? I can tell you emphatically, as I've talked to a few of them, you know, on background, members of the board, no, they don't. So I think the to some extent, the women are putting this sort of pressure on them that I think, you know, may be more effective than, continued years of kind of behind-the-scenes bargaining.
Mm. Do you agree, Professor LeRoy?
I do. I think Michael's insight is spot on, especially with the public relations value. And this is part of a broader leveraging process. As I understand it, one of the next possible steps for the women will be to engage in a strike. And it looks like a sort of a one-off kind of thing, strike during an event. But they can pressure the league on several different fronts, the public relations front, the legal front, the job action front. And you look at the mix and how they all come together, and there's little doubt in my mind that they will get an improved set of circumstances out of it. I'd be surprised, frankly, if we ever get to a court ruling. I think that would be years off in the future. And one thing we haven't talked about, but to mention in brief, the women are up against a 22-year precedent involving a very similar kind of dispute involving a USC women's basketball coach who was making the same kind of claim, and she was unsuccessful in her legal pursuit. So that's a precedent they're up against. But I think at the end of the day, Michael's right. The pressure that's going to be generated will result in a much better outcome for the women here.
Mm. And what about this strike? What are you hearing about that, Michael Powell? A strike saying we're not going to the Olympics, or what kind of strike?
I don't think it'll be the Olympics, but I mean, there's you know, they have events all the time and leading up to the Olympics, and of course every sports association, that is, if it's whether it's track or basketball, whatever, I mean, they do sort of a, if you will, kind of a pomp and circumstance march up to the Olympics, and they have tryouts and all that kind of thing. So there's any number, if you will, of kind of smaller pressure points to put on. And I suppose, right, you always have the sort of draconian step of the not going to the Olympics, but that strikes me as highly unlikely.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to our audience and find out what people are thinking. There are a lot of soccer players, female soccer players and male soccer players, huge sport all over the country. All of our kids were involved in soccer, and I'm sure that many of you are pretty tied into weekends with your sons and daughters playing soccer, and you love the sport, and you're also keyed in to this lawsuit. Five players on the U.S. Women's soccer team is what we're talking about this hour, acting on behalf of the entire team, filing a federal complaint last week accusing U.S. soccer of wage discrimination. And we're talking about that lawsuit. The EEOC is conducting an investigation here, which could go on for some 6 months to 10 months. One of the lawyers who's leading this with the women players told us at the top of the show. What do you think? Do you see great disparity here Do you think that U.S. soccer is really needing to address this pretty soon? What do you think it says to young girls who are playing soccer in the state of Wisconsin and beyond? What about the playing conditions? The pay disparity is pretty significant. So what should U.S. soccer do? They don't like what's happening here, and they'd like to make it better. What would make it better? Do you see the disparity? We'd like to get your response. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. And all of that is open to you right now. Let's start our calls with Michael in Middleton. Hi, Michael.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. I'm going to be brief because I think you and your first guest already made my point, and it doesn't go specifically to wage disparity. It goes to disparity of working conditions. And I saw a show on ESPN, which I wish I could cite. It was either Outside the Lines or E60, and it was about a woman who was a former goalie for presumably the national team, and she had got serious health problems from playing on the artificial turf with the recycled tires, and she'd gone around and collected, you know, like 95 other cases of youth soccer players working under the same conditions. So it's not just about wages. It's about, you know, disparate working conditions. And that's it. I'll shut up.
No, thank you, Michael. Three Michaels on the air at the same time. Michael Paul. Michael Paul, what do you say?
Oh, I mean, I think that's it's absolutely. I mean, it's just it's absolutely the case. I mean, they've ended up playing, and in fact, the women protested this, that they were playing on artificial turf and lousy artificial turf at that, and they were they raised less the question, though it's an important one of what your caller just raised. But they just said, look, you know, literally the seams were peeling up, and the potential to really suffer a bad ankle or knee injury was great, and they argued absolutely correctly that men, professional men, are not forced to play on these sort of fields.
Mm-hmm. Professor Leroy?
You know, it's fascinating to me how this resonates with talk in the 1950s and 60s about a segregated workplace. There, we were talking about racial segregation, and not only were you separating people on the basis of race, but you had clearly inferior working conditions for African Americans. And how fascinating it is that we're having an open conversation about indefensible differences in just the work conditions that the caller pointed out. So. It's good. I mean, it's good that we're having this conversation. It's good that a spotlight has been shown on it. And you have to think that improvements will be in the near future on this front.
Thank you, Michael, very much for your call. Sharon sends this email, wants to know if the men's soccer team also had signed a memo of understanding. If not, isn't the Federation setting up an example of difference right there? Professor Leroy.
Yeah, I don't believe that they have that same terminology, and I understand the thrust of the question. It's a nice question. It's an interesting point. Again, at the end of the day, I think when you look specifically at this, I think if it came to a legal ruling, the court would say, let's see what these parties have done here. And there was a labor agreement before, and so they have a context and a history. And then you have this idea of acquiescence or ratification, legal, terminology for, gosh, even though you call it something differently, you're behaving toward each other the same way as though you have an actual agreement. So we, the court, think you have an agreement. So I do think the women are, again, going to have a hard time moving out of that argument that of saying that we're free to go here, and we're free to take action on our own.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. A line is open if you'd like to join this conversation about the lawsuit filed by the U.S. women's soccer team. Five players speaking on behalf of the whole team filing a wage discrimination suit. EEOC is investigating now. Dan in Reedsburg, hi.
Hi. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit late. What's the difference in wage, I guess, between the average woman and the average male?
Yeah, it's fairly extensive. There are different parts to this. Either Michael, whoever wants to take this on, we can repeat it. It bears repeating.
Okay, well, I'll jump in. I mean, it's a bit in dispute because they get and it kind of depends how you slice it. In other words, the women claim that there's about a 40, depending on kind of how you figure it, a 40 to 50 even 60% difference. A lot of it, because a lot of that what they get is bonuses, and they get you get a certain amount of money if you're asked to try out for the Olympic team, you get a certain amount of money. If you make the Olympic team, the same thing with World Cup, same thing. And then once you make these teams, if you get a certain number of victories, you also get it gets very difficult to kind of put a finger on. All you can kind of safely say is that it seems to me is that the women are certainly paid less, and they're paid significantly less. Is it as significant as the women in their press release argued the first day? You know, U.S. Soccer's pushed back on that, and I think has raised, you know, a couple of fair points. But I don't think anyone would argue that it's remotely the same pay.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to add to that, Professor Leroy?
That is substantially true. The one point I would add is it's interesting to note that so much of the pay on both the men and the soccer women's side of this sport is contingent pay. I mean, it's dependent on outside appearances. It's dependent on how far you go in a competition, as Michael indicated. And so if you ever get to the point of a legal ruling, it would be difficult for a court to really get down to the hard business of calculating damages because unlike major professional sports where so much money is guaranteed, and not all of it's guaranteed, a lot of it has an incentive base and so forth, but there at least you're on more solid ground for comparing apples and oranges or fruit that is in between. But here you'd have a very hard time of estimating what is the actual pay for a male soccer player. And Michael's right. I mean, all the figures indicate that there's roughly a 40% pay disparity. And then when you throw in things like meals and fields are different and
right.
I mean, it's very different, no
mm-hmm.
doubt.
Dan, you want to carry on?
Well, yeah. I mean, they make a substantial amount of money, I assume, still. Plus, I would also estimate that women's soccer is probably 40% less popular in the world, I'm guessing.
Well, yeah. In the world, perhaps. In the United States, I think it's a very different question. In the United States, and again, to the credit of U.S. soccer, to the credit of the women, there's been a real effort to build a soccer base across genders in the United States, and it's been quite remarkable. And frankly, a lot of that credit also goes to the women, the professional soccer women, who have, you know, in their own negotiations pushed to get more money put into 12, 13, 14-year-old soccer leagues. And that's really kind of quite remarkable to see professional athletes, you know, essentially using that venue for something that's not going to bring any, you know, put any money in their pocket. Now, you know, internationally, FIFA has been, far less aggressive than U.S. soccer in doing this. And it's in fact been one of the complaints of the women's soccer players in the United States is that, look, we're building, you know, very rapidly a pretty professionalized game here, but that's not being matched because FIFA's not put historically the money into that internationally that U.S. soccer has in this country.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dan, very much for your call. More calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Let's go to Sherry in Whitewater. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Sherry.
I'll try to be quick.
All right.
When I was in high school, I graduated in 1975. There were no women's sports. We played a powder puff football game once a year. And so it was important to me when I had daughters of my own that they be able to play sports. And I got them involved in everything that was offered pretty much. But there was a stark contrast between how the different genders were treated. You know, the girls might have a T-shirt on their team. The boys are in full uniforms and that kind of stuff. I don't, you know, it's like the civil rights movement, you know, and the Voting Rights Act, all those things getting, you know, African Americans got the vote before women did. I should say male African Americans. So I think we're still on the journey. We're still in the process of trying to get equality, but we are definitely not there.
Professor Leroy, why don't you start?
I think that's a great observation, and when you describe it as a journey, I think that really frames this this legal action properly, which is to say whether it is fruitful in court or not, it'll be a catalyst for change. And if you look at, if we just start by looking at major league sports, and I'm talking about for men, it's 40 or 50 years ago, so I'm a graduate from the same high school era, and it's shocking in retrospect how poorly football players were paid. They were paid $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 a year, and if they were at the top, and now they get millions and millions. So how did they get from a small amount to a large amount? They got there with the kind of action that the women in soccer are engaged in today, a mix of a lawsuit, a mix of a labor action. To your point, a broad implication of this is not only will pay and working conditions improve for women's soccer, how it happens we don't know, but that should filter on down hopefully to the youth leagues and the high school leagues, but it is a journey, as you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Michael Paul, the historical thoughts here are striking, aren't they? It wasn't that long ago, and women just didn't play sports.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right, and I think we're demographically we're all in that in pretty much the same area, and yeah, I mean, I certainly remember that as a kid in New York. That I mean, the facilities and just the attention paid to the boys was vastly different than for the girls. And I think of this also, you know, when I wrote about this last week, I was thinking about this in terms of, say, gay marriage, where, you know, back and how quickly change came, and you know that what civil unions in the mid 90s, even late 90s, were seen as an almost radical thing, and 10 years later were seen as, you know, an impossible accommodation because people simply wanted the same right, which was to be married. And I think that, you know, something of the same phenomenon is happening to women's soccer. I mean, they had an agreement, it's absolutely true, you know, as late as 2010, that kind of set out these unequal pay arrangements. But, you know, sometimes history acquires a real velocity, and I think that we're at one of those points, and something that only 5 or 6 years ago seemed, you know, kind of commonplace and unremarkable now seems unjust.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Sherry. Scott in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Hello, and thank you. My point is pretty simple, that I really am tired of everybody whining and complaining about equal pay for this and that and whatnot. None of us are equal, no matter how you throw it out. There are men who are not equal to other men. There are women who are not equal to other men. We all can't do the same thing that everybody does, even if we excel at certain things. If the women want to be paid as much as the men, then let them go out and beat the men's team. Then they can prove that they've earned their keep. But unfortunately, I don't think you're going to see that happen. And it's just like a big league baseball team has a farm league. Those people can't beat the top echelon, so they're kept down. It doesn't make it wrong. It doesn't make it right. It's just the way the system works. But if the women want equal pay, I think they should go out and beat the men and see what happens. Secondly, let them go on strike, and they'll really see. It wouldn't bother me if all of them went on strike, because I personally don't watch a lot of sports. But that's all I got.
All right, Michael Powell.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I think there's a long history of both women and male leagues and you know, sectors of sport, and I think for reasons that are perfectly obvious. And the fact is that, as we talked about in, say, tennis, there's a really terrific and salutary record of, you know, both women and men competing separately and yet getting the, you know, I mean, that is within their gender. and yet getting more, you know, something much closer to equal pay. And obviously we see this in both the summer and winter Olympics. We see that in some sports the women outdraw the men, and you know, vice versa in other sports. So I guess I respectfully disagree with the caller.
So, Professor Leroy, why can't the women be more like the men?
Well, I think they are more like the men, and they're narrowing the gap. And if you look at what the women's soccer team achieved in the past 2 years, they're better than the men, and that's their argument. And I respectfully disagree with most of what the caller is saying. But I do want to pull out a point that's interesting for all of us to think about, which is, back in the late 1970s and early 1980s, when this kind of issue was confronted more directly and more broadly, there was this idea or theory of comparable worth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the caller makes a good point about saying nobody's equal. The caller said that. And to his point, he's right. You look at an NFL roster, tight ends don't make what quarterbacks make. Okay, so you've got inequality among men. And the caller's right. This idea that there is equality is it isn't true. Now I think we need to go the next step further and sort of figure out then what is the intrinsic worth, and why? I mean, it's fair for the women to ask, why are we getting 40% less money? And if the answer is because market conditions dictate it, then maybe that's an answer that one has to accept. But when you look at just the superficials of it, i.e. the women are at the back of the plane and they don't get the same meal money, that's an indication that there's something more systemic afoot, and they're stereotyping and some sort of differential treatment that you just can't justify with a business rationale.
Mm-hmm. Jim in East Troy, hi.
Hi, yeah. I think most of the points your guests are making, I would agree with. At the amateur level, and I would include the Olympics as an amateur level. I think men and women, if there's any compensation, should be the same. But all other sports, World Cup, that's professional. That's entertainment. And you keep bringing up women's tennis. Sure, and there's very good reason why you're bringing it up. Women's tennis is really popular, and TV contracts dictate how much women can get. And unfortunately, it's the same with women's soccer and the WNBA. There is no money there in TV contracts. I'm 100% for you in high school sports, college, and even Olympics, absolutely even. But professional sports, nope, sorry. Like the caller said before, there's a reason why the medium players don't make what the top level play. Your argument, if accepted, to me, if I'm the worst player on the women's team, I should be making every bit as much as the top player, because we're going through the same thing. We take the same risks. We travel the same way. I don't think anyone would agree with that.
Michael Powell.
Yeah, well, I mean, the caller raised an interesting point. I mean, the women are not – there is a women's professional soccer league. They are not arguing, and that has struggled so far. They're not arguing that those – wages should be the same as for men's professional soccer. There they take, I think properly so, a kind of longer view, and that goes back to, you know, hoping then and pushing that FIFA, the international body, does something more about building up women's soccer globally so that you could develop one day a real viable and well-compensated professional league. What they are talking about here is, you know, both the World Cup team and the Olympic team, and the amount of money they get for playing on those, and they're saying that is not equal. And there, they have a pretty good case, because their television ratings in this last round and their audience draw was, you know, equal to or better than that of the men. So there, you know, if you're in something closer to an apple-to-apple comparison.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye, gentlemen. We're out of time.
Sorry.
No, don't be sorry. Our thanks to you. It was really a good hour. Thank you. Thanks,
Thank
Michael
you.
Powell.
You.
Thanks, Professor Michael Leroy.
Thank you.
Michael Powell, the man behind the New York Times Sports of the Times column, Professor Michael LeRoy, Professor of Labor and Employment Relations and Law at the College of Law, University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, Eva Cole, partner in Winston Strawn. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting show, and to KP Whaley for on-air production. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. The artistic director of the Milwaukee Ballet will then join us.